All right, so I was asked to speak. Actually, I think I asked myself to speak on this topic, but, for what it's worth, but the Bible and evolution. Okay, and you're probably aware that there's sort of groups within Christianity that act as if evolution is the plan of the devil to destroy faith in God. And there's also people in the science / atheist community who think that Christians are idiots because of their stance towards evolution. All right? Now, that's a typical, you know, two opposite people not talking to each other very clearly. But I, hopefully at the end of this talk, you'll see that that's not necessary, that argument. So, our outline. I'm going to talk first about the age of the universe. And then I'm going to talk about the age of the earth. Then I'm going to talk about what Genesis chapter 1 says about creation. Then I'm going to talk about what Genesis chapter 1 says about evolution. And then I'll talk about the evidence for evolution. And then I'll talk about four possible Christian perspectives on evolution and science in the Bible. Okay? So let's talk about the age of the universe first. Some of you may be aware of this famous Bishop Usher, the Irish bishop in 1640, using the genealogies in Genesis, he calculated the earth to have been created in the year 4004 BC, and even got the date exact, October 23rd. All right, and so, in fact, I think if you'd asked most scientists in the 16th and 17th century how old the earth was, they probably would have said just a few thousand years. That would have been a scientific perspective, not based on evidence, kind of based on a Bible calculation, because most scientists were Christians. All right, so then I'm going to talk about the age of the earth. Historically, the age of the earth was established first, and then later the age of the universe was established. But since obviously the earth is younger than the universe, I'm going to talk about the age of the universe first. Common sense? Okay, good. So, cosmic speedometer, okay? I want to talk about the evidence for the age of the Earth. Now, all of you have heard the sound of a race car coming. It goes like this. Right? Do you know why it does that? All right, it's called the Doppler shift. When somebody's coming towards you, the waves are compressed, which makes a shorter wavelength and a higher frequency. And when something's going away from you, it makes a longer wavelength and a shorter frequency. And somebody's trying to illustrate that by that picture. Well, it turns out when, in the 1920s and 30s, astronomers got the ability to see very distant objects, such as galaxies, what they discovered was when you get more than about 30 or 40 million light years away, then objects are receding from the Earth. There's a red shift. Okay, so that's illustrated here. All right, this shift in that direction would be a red shift, and a shift in this direction would be called the blue shift. This is natural light coming from the sun. It says it starts from the sun. You see these black lines? All right, those are absorptions spectra from the stuff in the atmosphere of the sun. Doesn't matter. All right, so a nearby galaxy, all those lines are shifted to the right a little bit. All right, and then a distant galaxy, let's say 2 or 3 billion light years away, is shifted even more. And then the most distant objects, say a quasar that's 10 billion light years away, is shifted even farther. So do you see why they call it a red shift? And red is to longer wavelength and lower frequency. So what this showed is the universe is expanding. And interestingly, the closer things are to us, the more slowly they're moving away from us. And the farther they are away from us, the faster they're moving away from us, which gave the idea of sort of like a spherical expanding universe. Got it? And if something is expanding spherically or isotropically, to use a big fancy word, what that means is you can imagine extrapolating back to when it was really, really small. So then people came up with this idea of a big bang. All right? The faster the recession, the greater the red shift. I'm going to show you a graph. Don't you love science graphs? They're great. Okay, this is a graph showing the speed with which the object is moving away from us versus the distance away from us. Would you agree that that is a straight line? Okay? Yes? And there's some variation. There's some scatter there. Because local galaxies, some are moving toward us, some are moving away from us because there's some randomness there. All right? And in fact, the slope of that graph is called the Hubble constant. All right? So what this proves is that the universe is expanding sort of in a symmetrically spherical way. All right? So here's an illustration. If something is moving away from you, then let's say you could be anywhere in here. No matter where you are, everything is moving away from you. If you're in the front, everything's moving away from you. It seems to. Actually, you're moving away from it, but it doesn't matter because we can't tell that we're moving because velocity is relative. Am I okay so far? Mostly. All right. Good. So, winding backwards, the universe must have had a beginning. And the question is, when is that beginning? That was discovered in the 1920s and 1930s. And this Big Bang model was created at that time. But it's not like atheist scientists just collapsed at that point and said, yeah, okay, fine. The universe was created. Because atheists don't really like the idea of the universe being created, because that seems to imply a creator. But the Big Bang model made a prediction that there would be this background microwave radiation at a very cold temperature of about 4 Kelvin that should fill the whole universe. Then in 1963-64, Penzias and Wilson were making microwave antennas, and they got this static in their antennas. Like, it wouldn't go, man, maybe a bird made a nest in our thing, and it wouldn't go away. They mentioned that to a cosmologist friend. They said, you just discovered the cosmic microwave background radiation. You just proved the Big Bang model. Because no other model of the universe would ever predict this background radiation. So now we have 2 points showing the universe was created at some time in the distant past. One is, the other one is this microwave background radiation that fills the universe. All right? And then a third prediction was made. Using nuclear physics, the prediction was made as the universe expanded. When things expand, they get cold, right? And as the universe expanded, it got cold. Then first electrons and protons were made in the quarks. And finally, it started making atoms. And the question is, how many protons and neutrons would be in those atoms? And the prediction was the universe should be about 96% hydrogen, about 4% helium, and like point something percent everything else. And guess what? When they put their telescopes in the universe, they discovered that that's exactly... Oh, let me go back. Yes. Now, this is a log graph, so these are orders of magnitude. So something like 98% or 97% of all matter is hydrogen. The bottom line is, don't worry about the details. This model fits exactly what was discovered. And by the time you have 3 predictions from one model, which agrees with these 3 basic facts, and no other model could even come close to predicting those facts, the bottom line is, it's considered for all practical purposes proved that this event happened. Then the question is, how old is the universe, right? The answer is, well, whenever that event happened. Okay, got it? And there are 2 ways to measure it. One is to look at objects. And because we know that stars evolve over time, we can look and ask what apparently is the oldest star in the universe. And it turns out to be around 13.2, 13.4 billion years old. And then they ask, what's the farthest object in the universe? It turns out to be around 13.4 billion light years away. So therefore, 2 different separate methods that aren't connected in any way to each other, all are giving the same answer. The universe is around, there you go, around 13.3 billion years old. Now, I've taught a class, Science 110, which is for like non-science students who just want to get some 3 easy credits for science. And we talked about scientific observation and theory. And I asked, does that prove the universe is that age? And my students, who I trained well, said, it doesn't prove that. All it means is that all the data is consistent with that answer. You know what? I think that's how old the universe is. Okay? So 6,000, sorry, was it 4,006 BC? Not looking too good. Okay. Now, next. Yeah, best current estimates. I think that error bar is slightly smaller. I made this slide, I don't know, maybe 5 years ago or so. Okay, now, then how old is the Earth? Well, one thing we know, it's less than...
13.4.
Yeah, less than that. All right? So how is the age of the Earth determined? Well, first of all, there's a guy named James Hutton, 1787, he published Theory of Earth, in which he made the radical proposal. You have to understand, until the late 18th century, the unanimous opinion, more or less, was the Earth was quite young. Not because science said so, but because they were working from a sort of a presuppositional thing that had nothing to do with science, essentially. So Hutton, looking at things like this, this is in Scotland. He was a Scottish geologist slash philosopher. He asked, those layers, they must have been flat at one time. How did they get vertical like that? So he proposed, in quotes, no vestige of a beginning, no concept of an end. In other words, he proposed the Earth was so old that there's literally no object left as old as the Earth is. So if you were to ask James Hutton how old is the Earth, he would have said old. He said, could he be more specific? He would have said, very old. Well, how old? Very old. They had no way to measure the age of the Earth. There's literally none. Okay, so you have fast forward, and we talk about the estimates in the 19th century by Maxwell and others. I'm not going to worry about that. But clearly there's deep time. And Alice, you're going to go on that hike to the Grand Canyon. Okay, great. So we're going to go down there. And if you go to the Grand Canyon, and if you say that canyon is about 6,000 years old, I think you need to do some thinking, okay? So geology, cosmology tells us that the universe is around 13 billion years old. Geology tells us the Earth is very old. That's all we have so far until you go to, index fossils, William Smith, showing that, you know, there's this order and the relative age. That's by the early 1800s. They could say, these are older than those. How old are they? I don't know. They're just older than those. Trilobites are older than dinosaurs. Okay. Again, that's early 19th century. But then in the early 20th century, the ability to do radioisotope dating. All right. And that is not the kind of dating that happens on campus. This is measuring parent-daughter isotopes. So, for example, one of the pairs is uranium-238, turns into lead-206. Its half-life is 4.5 billion years. Now, in order to use that to determine the age of the rock, you'd have to know how much lead-206 was in the rock originally. There's all this stuff that has to go on. Let's say a rock was 99% uranium-238 and 1% lead-206. Is that rock fairly old or fairly young? It's pretty young, maybe 50 million years old. What if that rock is 60% uranium-238 and 4% lead-206? That rock is something like 3 billion years old. So scientists began to measure the age of rocks, but it turns out the age of the Earth is not determined by measuring the age of rock on the Earth. Remember, Hutton said, no vestige of a beginning? It turns out he was right, just barely. The oldest rocks on the Earth are slightly younger than the Earth. So where would you go to find an original rock? I'll give you a hint. That's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind. You go to the moon. There's been very little geologic activity. And by the way, believe it or not, also meteorites from Mars, or any meteorite from the formation of the solar system. And the meteorites that come to the Earth are about 4.5 billion years old. The rocks of the moon are about 4.5 billion years old. The rocks on Mars vary. Some as old as around 4.5 billion years old. And there are other isotope pairs. That's details I don't care about right now. So bottom line is, based on radioisotope dating, the Earth is something greater than 4.35 billion. That's the oldest rock found on the Earth so far. By the way, it might be 4.4 by now. I haven't read the last geographic whatever monthly thing. Moon rocks, closer to 4.5. The distance between the Earth and Moon, which is getting greater, and it's hard to estimate the exact rate because continent shapes, somewhere between 2.5 and 5. Bottom line is, the Earth appears to be about 4.5 billion years old. Okay? So that's the scientific information. All right? So let's talk about Genesis 1 and how, you know, Genesis 1, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth, blah, 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 first day, second day, third day, fourth day. I assume you all know about that. All right? And so I want to propose a few different means to justify that, possibly with the scientific evidence that I've been come up with. All right? I didn't invent these possible explanations. These are just the ones that are out there. One explanation is, well, the earth is young and science is right that it's young. Okay? Got it? In other words, there are people who will say, not only is the earth young, like the Bible says, but science has data that supports that. This is wrong! And anybody who says this is either ignorant or lying or I don't know what's going on. There are people like this. I'm telling you, there is absolutely no evidence at all that the earth is young. Okay? And I'm talking, there's people out there, right? Books, they stick with all this evidence stuff. In order to do that, they have to ignore basically everything that science does. All right? So if you came here and that was your opinion, you can do whatever you want with that. But I want to defend the young earth idea with my second possible explanation. All right? So I don't think you're a total idiot if you believe in the young earth, as long as you're willing to accept maybe, I just said idiot. Please erase that from the tape. You're not supposed to say that, okay? That was not coming from my heart, although, oh, maybe it actually was, but it shouldn't. I apologize. So the other idea is that God could have created it with an appearance of age. Now, this may seem like an absurd proposal. In fact, to me, it kind of actually appears that way, honestly. But Jesus made fish. And John the Baptist said, from these stones, God could create children of Abraham. And I happen to actually believe it. I believe the guy who walked on water, who made the fish, who raised Lazarus from the dead after 4 days, I believe that. And I believe that an omniscient, omnipotent, all-powerful, knowing, all-knowing creator could create the universe to appear old at the point of its creation. Okay? That's not a scientific proposal. In fact, if it were true, it would mean that science is going to give us a false answer. Now, there's a few reasons why I don't agree with this, but I don't think, if you believe that, I'm not going to have a big argument with you because you have every right to think that. Let me tell you why I don't like this explanation. Let's say we're looking through a telescope. By the way, go take a hike in the Grand Canyon. It's like, okay, why would God have done that? I mean, why would he put all those layers there if that stuff didn't really happen? But a better example may be looking through your telescope at a galaxy which is 1 billion light years away. Well, presumably, how long ago did the light that's hitting your telescope in your eye leave that galaxy? 1 billion years ago. So how old is that galaxy? I don't know, at least 1 billion years old. And if this is true, then dinosaurs and trilobites literally never even lived at all. So, there's sort of theological reasons to think, that seems a little fishy. Alright? By the way, I have a total of 5 explanations. The 2 in red, I say, are absolutely wrong. My opinion, you don't have to agree with me, but I feel very strongly they're definitely not true. The third one is called the day-age theory. This is kind of like the idea that what is the account in Genesis 1 anyway? Is it a scientific, historical, factual, you know, analysis with the radioisotope date? Basically, God said, first I did this, and then 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 I did this. And by the way, this idea was around in the first century AD, Philo, the Jewish theologian, proposed that. A number of early Christians also proposed this idea, this day-age theory. It was around before science was invented. All right? And so that's another possibility. I'm going to talk about that a little bit. And then there's another model that says, that's called the framework model, which says
that really those days are just a framework, that we shouldn't take them literally at all. They're just a framework. Basically it says, this is all the stuff God did, and we're just going to organize it according to this outline. Okay? I'll talk about that a little bit. And the fifth possibility is, it's just a myth. It's just not even true at all. There's no historical or truth content in that at all. It's just another myth. All right?
So, by the way, there's several reasons why I think that's wrong. I want to talk about that very briefly. All right, so let's look at sort of what we know about the history of the earth and how that might relate to the Genesis description. First of all, the Genesis story says God preexisted the universe and the earth. Okay? In the beginning, God. And then it says God created the universe. It says, let there be light. We call that the Big Bang. And then it says God created the earth. And then it says God separated the land from the water. So the earth became essentially a solid thing with water on it. And then God created life. And then God created humans. Okay? Which scientific, which thing here is in conflict with what we know from science? The answer is nothing. Of course, that assumes that you're allowed to interpret those days as metaphorical, which to me is common sense, and many Christians and Jews, long before science existed, assumed that was the correct interpretation. Alright, now a little bit more detail. The earth was created, it's already spinning. On the first day there's night and day, and then the water covers the earth, there's a very thick atmosphere, and then as the earth cools, the land forms, separate from the water, and then life appears on the earth, and then that life, believe it or not, the early cyanobacteria literally ate the atmosphere, So by roughly 3 billion years later, you begin to actually be able to see the heavens. All right, if you were on the planet Venus, how often would you see the sun? Never ever, because the atmosphere is too thick. So on the fourth day, as scientists would predict, after the atmosphere had been massively changed through living things doing to it, this heavenly objects appeared, and then more advanced life, and last of all, humans come along. Okay? All right, now this is the framework model, which says, basically, it's saying, first, day one is light, day two is sky, day three is land, day four is the luminaries that relate to the light, day five is birds and fish that sort of are in the sky, day six is land animals because of the land. So they're just saying, there's no historical content, it's just sort of categorizing everything that God made. Okay? I'm not a framework theory person. I have really good friends that are. I don't care. All right. What I do know is the information we have in the Bible is not in conflict with what we know from science if you simply allow a pretty obvious thing anyway, which is to take those days as metaphorical. Okay. Got it? Now, is Genesis 1 a myth? All right. Now if I take this word out, I could get in trouble with some of my Christian friends. Okay. You see that? But what is a myth? A myth is a simplified story given to explain the gods or God to common people. So every ancient culture had a creation myth. All right? And some of the other cultures had like the Babylonian had the primeval swamp with Marduk killing Tiamat and the blood from Tiamat that fell to the earth and it mixed with the mud and it made people. These other myths are like, okay, I mean, you don't actually believe that. In fact, I don't think the Babylonians took their myth to be true in any way whatsoever. So the only creation myth that I know, I've even heard of, which seems to reflect what we know to be true from science, is the Christian creation myth. So it's a true myth. Genesis 1 is a mixture of historical facts and religious truth based on these facts. By the way, I've said absolutely nothing about evolution so far, but we're through part two of our four-part outline, so it's time to start talking about evolution. So what does the Bible say about evolution? Not much. What the Bible says is God created every kind. of plant and animal. And it doesn't say that God created viruses and bacteria, because, you know, it doesn't mention dinosaurs either. Because the Genesis 1 story is not some sort of, you know, comprehensive scientific record of what happened. It's just saying, look, God created the universe, God created the earth, God separated the air from the land and the water from the land, and he created animals first in the sea, and then plants, and then he made people. Okay? So the bottom line is, if we want to know how species came about, we might have to look at species. There was a debate in Galileo's time over the age of the earth, and some people say, if you want to know how old the earth, how the earth moved and all that sort of stuff, the debate between geocentrism and heliocentrism. And it sure looks like the planets and the stars and the sun go around the earth, right? They assume that. All right, and the earth, the Bible said that, right? Because it talks about the sun rising and the sun setting, right? Do you believe in the sun setting? No, you don't. So it doesn't set. What does it do then? It stays there. The earth is spinning, right? But we talk about the sunset, right? So because the Bible had a language that sounded geocentric, they assumed the world was geocentric. But here's the thing. Galileo suggested in physical matters, we should do physical observations. The Bible is not a source of information about the physical universe. The Bible is a source of information about God. I believe every time the Bible makes definite statements that relate to scientific matters, it's correct, but that's not the purpose. It's the purpose of the Bible is that so we could have a relationship with God. All right, so if you want to know about the creation of life or the creation of species, what you do is look at nature and find out. So the Bible says God created all life in its various forms, but how did he do this? All right, remember the Bible is not a science book. So what we're going to do is we're going to look at the physical universe and we're going to ask what happened. I want to say one thing though, and that's another talk I'm not doing tonight. I'm telling you right now, life was created. There is no possible conceivable chemical beings by which life could come from non-life. I mean, if there is a slam dunk from nature, it is that. Now, I know that atheists will try to tell you they believe in spontaneous generation, but I'm telling you that is sheer nonsense. The kind of information, hundreds of millions of DNA, DNA nucleotides coming together to have the information to form proteins, which would have had to make the DNA and all this sort of stuff. I'm telling you, life is a supernatural creation. And the theory of evolution is not a theory about how life came to exist. Got it? The theory of evolution assumes that life existed. And by the way, if you read Darwin, even he said he believed life was created. He was not an atheist, he was a deist. Anyway, so the theory of evolution is not a theory about how life came to exist in the first place. I'm telling you, that was a supernatural creation event by the God of the universe. Life would never self-assemble and just sort of pop out of nothing. So the theory of evolution is a theory of change. It's not a theory of creation, it's a theory of change over time. Got it? So I'm going to talk about the evidence. I'll say this. The theory of evolution is a very good scientific theory. What makes a scientific theory a good theory? What makes a scientific theory a good theory is that the evidence is consistent with the theory. If the theory makes certain definite predictions, and then you go and you look, and the data matches the predictions of the theory, we don't say the theory is true. We say it's a good theory. That would work with the Big Bang model. The data is consistent with that model. Does that mean that's what happened? No. It means that's a good theory. And although the theory of evolution has some very significant problems for it that I'll talk about tonight, I still say it's the only theory that works. The only scientific theory, the only model that has ever had any significant explanatory capability to explain the data from fossils, morphology, genetic, DNA evidence, etc. So I can talk about the evidence for how the different species came to be. We're going to talk about how good a theory evolution is and why evolution seems to not explain everything. And therefore, we at some point, God had to have stepped in. Okay? So here's the famous finches of Darwin. Darwin goes to the Galapagos Islands. He assumes that the original population of finches was just the common finch in Ecuador or Peru or whatever. And yet there's all these different kind of finches that had filled every possible ecological niche there. And he reasoned, and I believe absolutely correctly, that from an initial population with a wide variety of traits, he didn't know anything about DNA, that those traits through a process of natural selection produced the species that are observed. But I would note this, that this theory is not a theory of creation of traits, it's a theory actually of elimination of traits. All right, anyway. So, is that evidence of evolution? The answer is absolutely. If evolution is the process of species changing over time, this is not just evidence, it's kind of like basically proof. Okay? And a number of other examples have been given. For example, the evolution of whales from some sort of land creature and all sort of stuff. By the way, sure, I don't know about that. I don't know about that. I'm very suspicious of that one. I'm just going to be honest with you. I'm not sure it's wrong. All right? But I'm suspicious of that one. So this is touted as proof, you know. Possibly. All right, then there's the horse thing. By the way, the horse one works really well. As far as I understand it, the sort of evolution of horses from ancient pre-horses, that's pretty solid stuff. That's pretty much, yeah, that's almost certainly what happened. So here's the deal. Evolution certainly has happened, change over time, and the question is the mechanism, which is mutations, genetic drift, and natural selection, is that sufficient to explain what we observe? Okay? That's the proposal. Okay? This is morphology. This is fossil evidence. Okay? This is morphology. And every mammal has 5 digits, which seems to imply some sort of common descent. It seems it certainly creates the impression that there was an earlier, maybe more limited range of 5-digit things that were walking around. And even the bat has 5 digits. It doesn't look like it. See that little teeny, itsy weensy thing there? And yes, even dolphins. I know, that's barely counts. Okay? So, this is evidence that certainly supports the idea of common descent. Yes? All right, and it certainly implies the idea of change over time through this process, mutation, genetic drift, natural selection. It's not a crazy idea. All right? And then there's the DNA evidence. I'm going to give a very quick summary. The fossil evidence broadly, mostly kind of supports this atheistic idea of evolution through just natural, random things. But I'd say sort of, kind of, but really not very well. I'll talk about that. So the fossil evidence is not in your face. Evolution is totally wrong. But broadly, the fossil evidence and evolution, more or less, there's something there. But the DNA evidence very, very strongly supports the idea of evolution and change over time. I'm going to get in your face right away just because you're not going to like me doing this. But this is 2 chromosomes that chimpanzees have. Humans, as you know, have 46, 2 pairs of 23. But actually, chimpanzees have 48 instead of 46. All right? But here are 2 of the chimp genes, right? You kind of see just look for yourself. It doesn't take a genius to see what's going on here. So it seems Possibly there was a common ancestor, okay? And either two genes became one, or one gene became two. It certainly seems that way. Does that prove that chimps and humans have a common ancestor? No. But it certainly is consistent with that idea. All right? And by the way, human, chimp, gorilla, orangutan. So the great apes, it seems that the great apes, it seems there's like this branch and then these three. It kind of seems that way. Okay? So if you want to say, oh, that's stupid, and you have to hate the Bible and hate God to think that there might be some sort of common ancestor between humans and the great apes, okay, well, just so you know, this information's out there. Okay? Let me repeat what I've already said. The fossil evidence weakly supports the idea of evolution, and the DNA evidence rather strongly supports that idea. Okay? Rather strongly. Okay, pseudogenes. These are genes that don't work. All right, there are, I believe it's six. There are six species that have the gene that makes vitamin C, but that gene does not work. And those are chimpanzee, orangutan, bonobo, gorilla, humans, and guinea pigs. But the mutation that made that gene not work is the same and different. Okay, got it? So that's evidence for common descent. But I thought the Bible said that God made Adam just boom like that. Okay. By the way, I actually believe that. But I'm just talking about this sort of thing. I've got a couple of books to suggest. One is Coming to Peace with Science by Daryl Falk, a good friend of mine. And then also The Language of God by head of the NIH, Francis. You know, the head of the NIH, the most famous scientist in America today. Yeah, what's his name? Anyway, it'll be later on this thing. That's embarrassing. Okay, anyway, there are other things like these short interspersed elements. In other words, if you try to imagine, for example, probably, say, dogs and foxes, you know, they might be more similar than dogs and cockroaches. If you take that view, what you'll find is these viral insertions, because every once in a while, it's a very, very, very random event, but every once in a while, by a random event, a virus will literally enter the gene pool of a species. And then all these subsequent generations have that chunk of virus stuck in there. All right? And if you look at these kind of things, you'll find out that animals that seems like probably, it's somewhat likely, they're probably reasonably closely related, will have the same viral insertions. Got that? Some of these apparently happened a really long time ago. Now, I suppose you could argue that God sort of put those viral insertions in there to fake us out or to trick us, but that seems kind of crazy. Okay, the bottom line is genetic evidence, at least in the large picture, supports at least the idea of common descent. Got it? Okay. Now, if this thing that we call evolution is the means by which God created all species, then that's not a problem. Although possibly when we see what appears to be the creation de novo of Adam and Eve, that might possibly raise some problems for some of us. We have to talk about that. We have to deal with the evidence. All right. So here's another slide. If we look at the actual functional DNA that actually makes enzymes, then the similarity between humans and chimpanzees, it's not 100%. It's more like 99.8%. They're just rounding off to the nearest percent. But if you look at the other random stuff that doesn't code for anything in particular, then you find only about 98% agreement. All right, humans to dogs, humans to mice, humans to chickens, humans to fruit flies, humans to round worms. If you look at the non-coding stuff, I mean, a lot of random stuff's happened. There's no information left in the non-coding part. Okay, got that? So now I'm creating this picture as if we're all done. That's the whole story. But I'm telling you, that is not the whole story. I'm giving sort of one side of the story here. Okay? Because it turns out when scientists start to do calculations, for example, when a cell divides, the number of mutations is roughly one in every 10 billion. So, DNA replication is ridiculously exact. And therefore, mutations are fairly rare. But then again, a human being has around, 3 billion base pairs. So that means between you and your parents, there may be a 30% chance there's some mutation somewhere in there in your 4 billion base pairs. The mutation rate is fantastically slow. Alright, and the question is, see that 98%? That means 2%. And 2% of 4 billion? Well, that's 80 million. 80 million mutations that happened, alright, when they only happen, maybe one third of, and how many people have even existed? So the statistics say random mutations certainly could not have created the change that happens over time. It just couldn't have. All right? So what we're back with is a mechanism that seems to explain a lot, but it doesn't explain everything. In fact, some of the most basic things it needs to explain, it can't explain at all. So when mathematicians and statisticians start looking at this idea that simple, just random changes. By the way, random changes do happen, and evolution has been observed in the laboratory. All right, people who have AIDS, the virus mutates even in their own body. But then again, you probably have, 100 million AIDS viruses, and every once in a while. So in species such as bacteria, for which there are trillions of them, evolution is actually observable directly, all right? But evolution, as in creation of successful mutations that are actually, carried forth to the next generation that can cause things to actually, acquire new traits, those are basically virtually not observed at all in advanced species. All right? So that's interesting. So there's a few problems with the standard model of evolution. We'll talk about the Cambrian explosion. And by the way, there have been several of these that have been discovered where essentially completely new body forms were created where there's literally nothing in the fossil record and nothing even apparently in the genetic record that could account for that. Okay, the body plans, we'll talk about that, 3D cell information, embryology. In fact, the fossil record shows no change, no change, no change, no change, maybe tiny bit of change, no change, no change, no change. Boom! Something completely different with no, because Darwin predicted that it would be a very, very gradual change over time. The bottom line is the fossil record is not like that, not even at all. The fossil record is nothing close to what Darwin would have predicted. All right? And that's why... Well, let me see. Let me get to my next slide here. So the Cambrian explosion, which happened around 440 million years ago, it turns out there are 27 phyla of animals. And of those 27, 20 of them appear in about a 5-million-year period. In other words, every kind of animal that exists didn't exist virtually, and then about 10 million years later, all of them exist. I'm not a biologist, by the way, so I don't even know all these. The arthropods and the vertebrates, all those things that you've heard about, okay? So these things go back 5 million years and nothing even remotely like these things with no prior even species that suggest these things. Never mind they could have evolved from. All right, trilobite, all right, et cetera. If you believe that whole tree thing, which I don't, by the way, if you do, then this is your closest relative on that screen. All right? I don't believe that whole tree thing. All right? So, when you look at the Cameron explosion, you remember that tree that you learned about? Do we have that tree? You know, like this, and you got your amphibians, your reptiles, that stuff. It's more like a little glade of several different trees. And seemingly 20 of them, all that were planted at about the same time. And evolution, the theory of evolution, this random mutation over time, simply seems to not be able to explain it at all. All right, so almost all the body plans, and by the way, there's no crossover. I mean, the body plan is created at the embryo stage. And once you get a body plan, that body plan never changes. It never, ever changes. Every single vertebrate has exactly the same body plan as this one does. And every single, whatever this is, I'm not a biologist. Every single, whatever those things are, I don't know what they are. Sorry. They all have exactly, body plans do not change in the fossil record ever. So the question is, where do they come from? I'll tell you what I think. I think God made them. And that's what the evidence strongly implies. Okay, so this would be life in the ocean during the Cambrian explosion. Some really bizarre looking things. Wind the tape back 10 million years. Not a single thing in there exists. And nothing that even looks like those things even remotely exists. And evolutionists do not have an explanation. They don't. They just don't. Okay? So here, to kind of break it down, the history of the Earth the whole time, you know, one-celled animals, colonies, some sponges, some things without any body parts at all, and then boom, almost every phyla comes into existence seemingly out of nothing in nearly zero time on a geological scale. Okay, so the question is, are random mutation, genetic drift, and natural selection sufficient to explain the data? I'll give you some quotes. The traditional concept of a tree of life, that natural selection is the main driving force of evolution, and the modern synthesis has crumbled apparently beyond repair. This is coming from an atheist evolutionist who's saying that monophyletic tree has collapsed. And there's nothing left to replace it. Okay, so here's another one. Life might indeed have had multiple origins. This is an atheist. Okay? And why is he saying that? Because the evidence very, very strongly implies it. Okay? Sudden emergence contradicts a tree pattern. Thank you for admitting that. Okay? So, although that evolution has happened is certainly true. And although evolution is by far the only scientific model that works, evolution is in big trouble. And where did that come from? From the data, from the evidence. So I want to propose that the reason is God has intervened in different times for different reasons. When and how he did, I don't know. I'm not going to claim to know. Okay, let me see. A couple more things concerning the monophyletic view of life. Wherever we look at the living biota, discontinuities are overwhelmingly frequent. The discontinuities are even more striking in the fossil record. In other words, if you look at the genetic information, you're going to go, But if you look at the fossil record, you go, come on. Give me a break. That's what he's saying. These are all materialist scientists who don't believe in God saying this. Transforming a single fertilized egg into a complete animal is a marvel and mystery. This is embryology. And one thing that scientists are noting is, actually, there is a massive quantity of information in a cell that's not found in the DNA. All right, for example, the different, why does this thing end up over here? And why one fertilized egg, do you get whatever, how many different kinds of tissues are there? And how do they know to do that? And how do the liver cells know to be only there in the liver and not over here? This kind of stuff is not found in the DNA. All right, so where is it found? It's information that was created and is inherited by a process that isn't even known. It seems to just sort of come along from the cell. So there, and over time, the amount of information that is contained in a cell that it seems beyond measure, impossible to even imagine, it's actually found in the DNA, is massive. So the question is, okay, if DNA contains the basic information to make the enzymes, that's true. Where is the sort of 3D information that makes a cell? And where's the information that makes one cell divide and to produce Noe over here? And it is what? It is a marvel and a mystery. That's an atheist. Okay? The problem of biological form remains unresolved despite the genetic activities in embryonic development. What orchestrates the hubbub of enzymes, filaments, membranes, and polymers into a recurring pattern? We really do not know. And I believe it's God. That's what I believe. Now, I'll talk about God of the gaps here, but so some tentative conclusions. I've got about 10 more minutes here. About 10 more minutes. First of all, evolution's happened, and if you think it hasn't, if you think evolution is some sort of plot by a bunch of anti-God people, just make it's not true. Evolution has been observed in the laboratory, what we call microevolution. All right? Fossil evidence supports the idea of change over time. Definitely. But that change often happens in surprisingly sudden bursts, so sudden that it seems that the current theory of evolution can't explain them at all. I believe it strongly implies that God did something. Strongly. Genetic evidence gives rather strong support to the idea of common descent. Okay? It's not a crazy idea. It's consistent generally. The idea of common descent is generally consistent with a genetic information. Common descent of humans and the great apes is not a crazy idea. Okay? It is not a crazy idea. Okay? Statistical and other arguments give support for evolution being theistic rather than deistic. In other words, that somebody was intervening, that there were multiple actions by means and timing of which we can't say. But if that were true, then that would not be a scientific thing to talk about. Scientists can only talk about things that happen by natural law. And if supernatural things happen, then the scientist has to just be quiet about that. But if you assume they didn't happen, then you'll conclude they didn't happen because you assumed they didn't happen, and that's what happens. Okay, got it? God invented evolution. Let's give him credit. Good job, God. Good job, God. Woo! That was pretty smart. The whole DNA thing, the incredibly precise and yet occasional mutations. Because if you didn't have occasional mutations, then when things changed, the species would just all die out. So that there's got to be a means for things to change. Now, all right, so here we go. So we put on a public forum. This was several years ago, about 8 or 10 years ago. Four Christian views of evolution. So I want to talk about four possible ways of thinking about this information that's out there. By the way, three of these I think are absolutely tenable for a thinking, scientist, Christian believer. One of them, I think you better rethink it. So we had the young earth creationist guy, Kevin Anderson. We had John Clayton, who's actually a friend of mine, who defended the intelligent design idea. Some guy who used to have brown hair but is now gray, defending theistic evolution, and my good friend Dennis Lamrose defending what I would call deistic evolution. So let me talk about those four. Okay, scientific young earth creationism. If you take that position, what you're saying is that the science is just not true. Because if you say that, then you're saying everything cosmologists is telling us happened, it actually didn't happen. All right? And it also says everything geologists tells us happened, just didn't happen. All right? In effect, to be a scientific young earth creationist, in other words, to say that according to science, evolution didn't happen. In fact, God made the earth, boom, basically the way it is right now, that's why he made it. So to do that, you have to essentially reject science altogether. That's a problem for me. It requires rejecting science and also general revelation, the idea that God reveals himself through what nature did. And I think it's pretty awesome going to the Grand Canyon and seeing what God did. It's amazing. It's not scientific. It's arguably anti-scientific. So let's not spend time on that one. Remember I talked about the theological idea that God created the earth appearing young? This also requires you to say that everything cosmology is telling us is wrong, and that everything God, that geology is telling us is wrong, but then it's saying it because God just did it that way, because God could do whatever he wants. And I'm not going to, if God wants to do that, amen, praise the Lord, okay? But you have to understand, if that's your view, that means that evolution essentially didn't happen. That the appearance of evolution in the fossil record is essentially put there by God to what? Fool us or something? That doesn't seem right. Okay, the third one is intelligent design. So there's a whole intelligent design movement. I just finished reading this rather thick book. This is by an intelligent design guy. These people honor God, absolutely, as they should. But they tend to be very, very skeptical of evolution. Basically, they say microevolution has happened. Everything else was done by God. So they reject macroevolution. They completely and utterly reject the idea of common descent as being simply not true at all. They're skeptical of evolution in general. They argue for irreducible complexities. They make what I would call God of the gaps arguments, which are susceptible to being proved wrong. That's the problem. So if we're going to make a God of the gaps, in other words, I don't know, I can't explain this, God, all right? When you do that, I think we should be really hesitant to do that. Because it could be that there's a scientific explanation. If you kind of take your stand there and say, definitely there's no common ancestor between chimpanzees and humans, and then you find the those retroposons and those SINEs and all those pseudogenes, you kind of go, well, I have to explain that. Okay? So they use God of the gap arguments, and they are not scientific arguments. That doesn't mean they're wrong, because God is a God of the gap, as in he raised Jesus from the dead. That's not scientific, that's for sure. I believe miracles happen. I absolutely believe miracles happen. The Bible, miracles happen. All right, but proposing them every time you see something you can't explain seems to be a bit of a stretch. So I'm a little bit cautious about a fairly strong intelligent design position. They tend to confuse theological questions with scientific ones. But my good friend John Clayton is in that camp. Amen. Okay, good. Theistic evolution, this is how I see things, for what it's worth. You reach your own conclusion. So this position accepts the implications of cosmology and geology, and broadly accepts evolution as a good theory that's useful to explain many of the things that are observable. They accept common descent as a reasonable proposal. Right? Is it possible that God had a plan and he put it into effect some way or another? And so is it possible the reason amphibians are similar to reptiles is because God made amphibians similar to reptiles? That's not a crazy idea. But if that's true, what I just said is not a scientific statement. Got it? So this position is comfortable with common descent, but would impose the very high likelihood that it's because God created that common descent. So this view sees free will and God's sovereign will in history, in individuals and in nations. So let me say what I mean by that. All right, I believe humans, generally, God does not intervene, generally. Right, so you're trying to get to work, And if the light's red, sorry, buddy, God doesn't change it to green for you. And I believe that God miraculously intervenes in our life rarely. Yes, I pray and I see stuff happen. I kind of go, wow, that was really cool. But, you know, God doesn't select who wins the elections. And God does not choose who wins the Super Bowl. And God, you know, if I were to let go of this thing, it's flat out going to fall. You know what I'm saying? And even if everybody in this room prayed that it didn't, I think it still would. You know what I'm saying? So I believe there's a kind of free will in our lives. And yet God every once in a while says, nope, here's what's going to happen. I believe that's true of us as human beings. I believe that's true of history. Every once in a while, God says, nope, I'm going to set my people free. But even the history of the Jews is a picture of hundreds of years with no obvious intervention of God at all. And then boom, 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 these miracles happen, everything. So I believe that history, God lets history happen as it does, except every once in a while he says, I'm going to step in and I'm going to do something. So I believe there's free will in history. I believe there's free will in us as individuals. And I believe there's a kind of free will in nature. In other words, God created the laws and they just work the way they work. But every once in a while, God says, yeah, but right here, here's my plan. So, Pharaoh, I'm sorry, but I'm going to sort of, you know, step in here and, you know, Judas, that sort of thing. Got it? So I believe this idea is consistent with what I know about God on every level. So that God created this physical set of laws that, and like to me, the way the whole evolution thing works, it's crazy. It's amazing. It's beautiful. But every once in a while, I believe God says, yeah, but, you know, I'm going to be making some, I don't know, some dinosaurs, or I'm going to be making some whatever. All right? So God works through evolution, but he directs the path either by subtly directing or by dramatic intervention or both. I don't know. Here's the problem with my view. I don't know. I honestly don't know. I don't know when, you know, Cameron explosion. There you go. I mean, there you go. You know what I'm saying? And how about us? How about us created in God's image? That's an intervention right there. All right. So did God take, you know, stuff and just sort of, there's Adam and there's Eve? Is that what he did? Or did he take two evolved, intelligent primates and put his image into them? I don't know. It doesn't matter to me. I really don't know. Science is not going to help me out there. All right? But I'm telling you, we are a special creation. We are a representation of a definite intervention. Because we have choice. We have sovereignty. We have the ability to create, to feel, to know, to be self-aware, to love, and to give love. We are a special creation. All right. So, to finish up on this view, although some scientific evidence and even statistical arguments support this conclusion, this is a theological proposal. This is, when I say that God intervenes at various times and in various ways, which I cannot delineate exactly, that I believe that is absolutely consistent with all the evidence. It's absolutely consistent with everything I know about God. In fact, it's the only explanation that makes sense to me. But when I say God intervened, don't plan on being able to do a scientific experiment to show that, because it's not going to happen. Okay? The last of the four views, God's relationship with history is theistic, but with free will. With us, the same. With the universe, seems to be the same. God uses nature to support our faith, but not to demand it. All right? He doesn't do these crazy stuff all the time. He doesn't write in the sky, here, you better love me or else, you know, you're going to fail your test. God seems to allow us to not believe if we choose. God gives sufficient evidence that common sense says, obviously God, but if you choose to not believe, he allows you to. Got it? Although the evidence supports evolution of human beings, Adam and Eve were special creation, there's no way they aren't. just the means by which God did it, I have to say, I don't know. I'm not sure. I'm just not sure. I want to be humble enough to admit I don't know. Okay? Evolutionary creation of deistic evolution, that would be the position of Daryl Falk and of my friend in the debate there. They accept cosmology, geology, and evolution, all these things as being true. They accept common descent as a scientific fact. They believe that evolution was purely natural. In other words, God set it up, and he let it go. And through purely natural processes, the entire thing just happened. All right, God could have done that, but I don't think he did. Both because the evidence doesn't seem to agree with that, and second of all, it's not consistent with his character. So this is a possibility. I have some good friends who are very, very faithful believers who take this position, and I say, amen, praise the Lord. But I don't think it's true. I mean, that's just what I think. Got it? So basically, this is a theory of a God of no gaps. And others will say, you're not allowed to propose God did something here, because if you do, you're breaking the law of this idea. But who said that? Where did this come from? It didn't come from the Bible. Darwin wasn't around long enough to even be able to have this debate. He died before even genetics. Actually, genetics was discovered while he was alive, but then Mendel died, and they picked up on it about 30 years after he died. Genetics. So Darwin didn't know enough to have a position on that, but if I know Darwin, I've never met the guy personally, but I'm pretty sure that Darwin would have been okay with this. That probably Darwin would have grabbed onto this idea. He was not an atheist. He was a deist. If you read his Origin of Species, he talks about God. He talks about creation. Okay? Anyway, if God had to intervene, he would be correcting his mistakes. So their argument is, this is a more powerful God than the other one. Which is true. I mean, if God could just sort of create all the laws and all the, and just Malcolm and just let it go and out pops us 3 billion years later, that'd be amazing. This is a more powerful God, I guess, in a way, than the actual one. So that would be their argument. They're saying you're giving less glory to God if you're one of these theistic evolutionists. All right, you know. I don't care. But I'm just showing you the options. Remember, there were five options at the beginning. Two of them are ruled out. Absolutely. Absolutely ruled out. Okay? So, we got some options, and I'll take some questions. All right, so God's relationship with history. All right, evolutionary creationism. All right, summary. Atheistic view of evolution is ruled out because life was created. And if life was created, and it certainly was, then atheism is wrong, period, end of story. But is it possible that purely natural processes produced everything that's observable? It's possible, but not likely, given the evidence. That's deistic evolution. That's not atheistic. Atheism is ruled out. Scientific young earth creationism is ruled out by the evidence. Theistic evolution, intelligent design are reasonable proposals, and none is without problems. We should be tolerant of divergent views, especially on things that are not essential doctrines of Christianity or even of science. All agree that we are fearfully and wonderfully made. Can I get an amen on that one? Fearfully and wonderfully made. Yes, very wonderfully made. So, there's those, yeah, Francis Collins. Thank you, Jan. Some dude named Francis, right? Francis Collins, possibly the most famous scientist alive today, the head of the NIH, but he's a very, very firm believer. Daryl Falk, friend of mine, Stephen Meyer. This is really great. It's about a $45 book, and I don't really like the attitude, but it's a really great book. All right, so I'll take a few questions. If there are any. Yes, Jen. Well, if you're going to say the earth is young, you're not saying that because you went out and did a hike and concluded it's young. The only reason to say it's young would be to take a view of the Genesis creation account and assume that those days are literal 24-hour periods. If you do that, if you're taking that literally, then you're probably going to take all the genealogies also literally, and also the ages of the 700 years and the 900 years also literally. So then you do a calculation, and you're going to come up with several thousand years old. Okay? But then you take a carbon-14 dating thing, and you find out that thing is 35,000 years old, and then these people are like, well, okay, you know, maybe, and they get in big trouble. Okay? Yes, Alex. Yeah. Again, so I proposed, this is a proposal, okay? I proposed that God sort of did a hybrid thing of natural and then, so the idea of common descent, it seems to be consistent with what you can observe. All right? And so God used this process of evolution. So I believe whether God intervened, you know, let's say, for example, let's say we're somehow have a common ancestor with a chimpanzee that has a tail, let's say. Do chimpanzees have tails?
No.
No, okay. With something that has a tail, okay. All right, and then if for some reason this thing is no longer climbing in trees and eating that tail, over time that organ would become vestigial through a process of evolution. And that could easily happen through a process of microevolution. Okay, for example, look at dogs. Now, the different species of dogs are created not through natural selection, but through unnatural selection. But what nature can do through natural selection, humans can do through unnatural selection, let's say 100 times faster. And so you got Chihuahuas and we have, Labrador Retrievers. And so, the existence of vestigial organs is consistent with microevolution. By the way, my personal opinion is those who try to make a clear distinction between micro and macroevolution, they've got a problem, which is where is the division between those? At what point is it micro? At what point it is macro? Good question. So, microevolution involves these processes. You know about these processes. I know you do. Everybody here knows about these things. So let's say you have a gene pool, and the gene pool includes a gene which causes sickle cell anemia. Okay? But sickle cell is a recessive trait. So you have to have two of them, all right, in order to get sickle cell. But what if you only have one of them? You don't get sickle cell, but you inherit an ability to resist getting malaria. So the mutation that happens seems like it happened at some point, all right? And if that mutation has a possibly positive effect, then it gets accepted into the gene pool over time. Okay? So was the original population of human beings, did they have lighter skin or darker skin? Probably a mixture, but those who lived in areas with a very bright sun all the time, they had a higher survival rate if they had more melanin in their skin. Those who lived in either very far north or south climes, man, if they had a lot of dark skin, they didn't get enough vitamin D, they started dying. That's microevolution. That's human microevolution. And so that's a process of natural selection. Natural selection only eliminates traits. Natural selection does not create traits. It only can eliminate them. So there has to be a mechanism to create traits. That mechanism theoretically should be mutation. But something like 99.999% of all mutations are either deadly or have no effect. So mutations that can create a survivable trait are fantastically rare. But they do happen. Right. Now, it turns out every gene that acts uses energy. Okay? So nature tends to drop enzymes rather than create them. Okay? And so apparently the evidence seems to say sometime, I don't know, 20 million years ago, some population of something seemingly, you know, before us lost the ability to produce vitamin C. Maybe they were living around a bunch of orange trees, so it didn't matter. You know what I'm saying? And then now you fast forward 5 million years, and now you've lost, it's like lactose intolerance. There's a perfect example. Lactose intolerance is found in populations that don't eat milk. And the ability to make lactase uses energy. It's better to not make lactase, the enzyme to digest lactose, than to make it. And if you live in a place where you don't eat milk products, then you lose the ability to make lactase. That's evolution. Okay? That's microevolution. But what we're talking about is macroevolution. For example, to create those 20 phyla. The evidence says that literally does not happen. Or if it does, it happens through an unknown mechanism. The idea of punctuated equilibrium was proposed in the 1980s and 90s, but that theory has kind of gone by the wayside because they haven't come up with a theory to explain how punctuated equilibrium even could happen. All right, it's the idea that basically nothing, 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 147 million years, then boom! Sort of this propensity to change is stored up over time and then it suddenly gets expressed. That's a great idea, but the evidence doesn't support it. So generally scientists stop talking mostly about punctuated equilibrium. All right, probably too many big fancy terms for you there, but any other questions? Yeah. Like I said, mixture. All right, so Origen of Alexandria, he took that to be metaphorical. What's his name? Tertullian took it to be literal. Irenaeus took it to be literal. Augustine took it to be figurative. Philo took it to be figurative. And it was more their predisposition to how to interpret the Bible that determined how they saw it, rather than of some, I guess, evidential reason to choose one or the other. All right? But the reason I even mentioned that before is I want to show that, because critics of Christianity will say, yeah, the only reason you ever even propose this idea is because you're trying to save your butt. That is not the case. It is a very natural interpretation to take this story as largely metaphorical. Largely metaphorical. It's a story about what God did. Genesis 1 is a polemic against the Enuma Elish, the creation myth of the Assyrians and the Babylonians. That's primarily what it was. For example, it says the two lights in the sky, it doesn't even mention the sun and the moon. Why? Because they worship the sun and the moon. So it's much easier to explain what's going on in Genesis 1 as a polemic against the accepted model rather than an attempt to give a detailed historical sketch. However, like I said, the basic outline just so happens to be consistent fairly well with what we believe we know to be true from science. So I say that's not a coincidence. Like I said, it's a true myth. Because again, read the Iroquois myth, read the Greek myth, all these other myths, you kind of go, okay, yeah, that's obviously not what actually happened. I mean, obviously that's not what happened. You know. Okay? Great question. Alex, another question. Go for it.
How should Christians view human genetic modification?
View what? Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. We put on an entire conference on this topic in San Diego a few years ago. And it was on basically ethics and Christianity. And one of the guys, he did a better job than I ever could have done. And basically he said, anything that God would have done naturally, to do it through science seems to be probably okay. For example, Jesus went and healed people supernaturally. And if we can do a genetic change that will heal people naturally, it seems to be consistent with who God is. But on the other hand, to put probes into your brain and give yourself an ecstatic experience through some sort of, you see what I'm saying? So what doesn't happen naturally otherwise, or what's not consistent with what God seems to want to do generally anyway, we probably should not do. So, yeah. So trying to select for tallness or for white skin or these kinds of things, these eugenics seems to go against ethics. Very much go against ethics. But I believe genetic changes such as to basically do a genetic gene therapy to cure sickle cell. That is intervening in the natural, but you're curing sickle cell. So I think a certain common sense applies. The kind of things that Jesus did anyway, if we can do that through a scientific approach, I don't see that as being unethical. But it's a hard question, and no matter how well you define all these things, you're going to come across an example, you kind of go, wow, I have to scratch my head. So we have to have a certain amount of open-mindedness, a certain amount of humility, that we won't all agree on those things. But the fact is, Christians have virtually no control over this. That's the problem. And we live in a world where if it can happen, it's going to happen. You just have to figure out what you're going to do about that, unfortunately. That's a great question. It's not really, it doesn't relate to this talk, but that is a really important question. But I would say this, Christians ought to get out ahead of this. In other words, our tendency is people do it and then we react to it. I think better is to conceive what's probably going to happen and for us as Christians to speak to that before it actually happens. That way we might have some ability to maybe have some effect on what actually happens. The big thing is AI, of course. But it's not just AI. Neuroscience, in the last 30 years, the big thing was biotech. That the revolution in the last 30 years has been biotech. In the next 30 years, the revolution is going to be neuroscience. We're going to develop abilities to do things unnatural in our brains. And I think we as Christians should get ahead of that, should think through those kind of things and start saying stuff before that actually happens. Okay, this is that's a very important question. All right. I think Malcolm is going to come up and make a couple closing announcements, unless there are more questions.
I was going to ask more towards that area of what Alex was saying, that's kind of a different topic, but basically with gene editing specifically, like I guess with DNA cells, like DNAs, and just like the way I guess things are born, just, you know, humans, you know what I mean? That's going to change a lot of those things. When it says, you know, created in the image of God, and we change those things, like what's, you kind of already answered it, sort of. But like,
true, but you're wearing a hat, right? You were made in the image of God. Why are you changing it by putting a hat on there? I mean, that argument could be applied to anything.
Okay.
And so I'm suspicious of that argument. You know, if by that argument you wouldn't use antibiotics. So you would die every time you got an infection. You'd just die. So that argument has been used against every technology ever created. So you have to have a justification for saying no. Okay? And so, yeah, you could be a troglodyte and a, you know, but I say First of all, what science makes it possible to do is probably going to happen anyway. That's not an excuse. I'm just saying that. And so to be against everything, you know, just because anything we do to change anything that happens naturally, I think that's you'd probably go to jail. I mean, you won't let your kids see a doctor. So I would say things that are consistent with the kind of things that Jesus said and did, even if they're not natural, such as taking antibiotics so you don't die, or such as taking chemotherapy so you don't die of cancer, I don't see that as inherently sinful. But there are things that I believe are interventions that God would not be pleased with. Okay? Yeah. Cloning is a big thing. Everybody's up in arms about cloning. Cloning is this horrible, just terrible thing against God. Did you know there are tens of millions of clones living right now? It's called identical twins. So since God... Right? That's a clone. So if you're against something, you need to think through why. By the way, I'm against cloning, by the way, just so you know. Not because it's against God, but because cloning is certainly going to cause all kinds of health issues. We should not, it's wasting a lot of money just for rich people anyway. There's no possible ethical reason to clone. So I'm against it. But not because cloning is evil, because if cloning was evil, then God kind of is evil when he made identical twins because they're clones. You have to think carefully. I know it's hard work, but I know you can do it. All right. Malcolm. You're going to come up and end our thing.
Yes.
Maybe make a couple of announcements even. Who knows? Possibly. And mention my books.
Give you a roll.
Come on! Come on, sign up!
It's gonna be intense, as I said.
Get it?